I think investing has been purely luck. Like, I don't think people, I think most VCs take or investors take too much credit. Somebody posted about this recently where they said that most investors will be net positive. They just help retweet and just say, "Great update, cheers." Be an email as well. And some of the text messages on WhatsApp and stuff, I've realized voice notes are just amazing,
Game
like
changers.
game changer. And even on Slack and stuff. So asynchronous communication, I've adopted to that fully. So saying no to more meetings and stuff, because most meetings are waste of time. Like, I think.
Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. I'm your host, Jivraj, and today I have a very special guest. Join me in welcoming Utsav Somani, who's a partner at AngelList India, who has built iSEED as one of India's leading solo GP funds, and who's done multiple other things that we're going to explore today. Thank you so much, Utsav, for joining me. Very delighted to be having
My
you.
pleasure, Jivraj. Thank you for having me. I'm slightly nervous, of course, excited to be here. The kind of guests that you've attracted on this podcast is just phenomenal. So thank you. My pleasure.
The pleasure's completely mine. I think I've had the pleasure of knowing you for the last 2.5, 3 years. I've had the honor to work alongside you, and it's been lovely. This has been a long time coming, and I'm so glad we are finally doing this. A lot of thoughts in my head because, I have the entire context of knowing you inside. But maybe let's start off with what's the most interesting thing as per me, and defines a lot of what you've done in the past, right? The way you started AngelList India is actually, as legend would have it, a cold email to Naval. And knowing him and what's, of course, out there in the public about him, it could have only been very challenging. Maybe talk to us about how you wrote that email, what's the context there, and maybe let's get started there.
Getting to the fun stuff quickly. So the cold email, I think that's a story that I've discussed previously, but I think, I mean, the important bit was I wanted to, like, I mean, sort of rewind back to what led to that email and what was my mindset on that day that I wrote that email.
Please.
I actually wrote two cold emails. I'm not going to share the second one, but the first one went out to Naval. And I had experienced this angel investing in India through different things, right? Angel investing 1.0 was offline networks and stuff. Angel investing 2 was, like, say, online, other online platforms where people were meeting. Founders and investors were coming together online from, like, different cities, smaller cities, given access to these opportunities online. But I think there were fundamental differences that I had identified. And I had heard Naval Ravikant come and talk about his personal philosophy, his life, and then I went down the rabbit hole where, like, almost everyone does if they listen to Naval on the podcast or, like, just anywhere. Discovered the company as well, AngelList, right? What they've created and this model that they've created through Syndicate. It solves for all the three pieces of angel investing together. Like, there are these people from different cities or smaller towns or traveling who want to, like, say, invest in these high growth opportunities. There are people who want to monetize their access and judgment. And there are, of course, these founders who want a single cap table check. All of this was entirely new. And I was like, man, this pop-up VC fund structure is just insane. And I want to work for this guy who's got his personal life figured out, who's got his work life figured out, and is in the same industry as me. So I was like, I mean, take as many shots as you can. So I wrote a cold email to him one fine morning, and he replied, I think, in a couple of hours. And then we got talking, and I think it was a 2-3 month process to, like, figure out what they want to do in India. Like, I think Naval mentioned on that email that he had already explored India, but I mean, of course, Naval has a soft corner for India because he's born here and was here until he was at least 8, 9 years old and then shifted to the US. So he had a soft corner for the Indian continent, I mean, as a country, India as an ecosystem, and of course, the startup ecosystem and the excitement here. So he replied, at least. So that was the first foot in the door. And that email was very crisp, like how Naval mentions, right? I mean, an email should not be more than, like, a couple of paras, and you just get to the point, right? Get to the meat of it pretty quickly. Like, I mean, all of these people, the smart people, they all read their emails. And I've seen some of the most successful people actually be the quickest with their emails. I don't know, somebody's discussed this and, like, wrote about this publicly as well, but I've seen the best people are very quick with their emails. So a cold email done right is the best non-linear shot that you can take. And I hadn't read that Naval's tweet where he says that buy Bitcoin, write a tweet, write a book, yeah, or create something which is non-linear, go on as many first dates as possible and all of that stuff. But I read it much later in my life, and I added that write a cold email as many times as you can, because it takes like, what, 2 minutes to write this thing. Of course, you can spend hours in refining your writing skills, but a cold email is literally just 1 or 2 minutes. And if you can do that like consistently, I've connected with some of the best people in the world through this. Like, I think Chris Sacca, Mark Andreessen, Naval Ravikant, Tim Ferriss, Ellard Gill, Lockie Groom, all of these people, I have never asked for a warm intro, because warm intro, I think, brings with it a certain bias as well. Because you're asking somebody to burn their social capital or use social capital. So in a cold email, you've not taken a favor from somebody, so nobody's going to be obliged, and it's directly going direct, right? I mean, Naval says that all your stuff should be direct if you can get to it. So I think a cold email is the best thing that you can do direct.
Absolutely. You know, I think it goes to that tweet, I think limited downside, unlimited upside. And I've been fortunate to have a bunch of guests on the show because of a cold email. But it's so glad. I think it's perfect that we started on that note. Very important to echo. Let's maybe, you know, go back to a bit of context, build some for the audience. You've now been investing for a while as an angel, as now a fund manager, before that syndicates. What got you into, you know, tech investing? What's the genesis of your interest into this spectrum? And what got you interested in startups to begin with, right? Like, maybe walk to us about that story.
So I've been doing this for 8-9 years now. I think 2014 was my first investment. But before that, I was a self-taught programmer. I learned PHP and Java in school, and like, I was a big geek. I used to teach and read about like all of these things and stuff, and started coding applications and stuff. Then went to Singapore to do my undergrad. So I did information systems and took up a second major in finance. And after that, I worked with HCL, which was an IT job. And then I worked with Bank of America and private banking. So I've explored finance and IT both. And I realized that I'm not good at either. So I think the first half of my career was what not to do in life, I think. And that's how you should be. Like, I mean, be more experimentative and stuff. But I was not doing this with that mindset that I want to experiment. I think it was just that, oh, this is not something that I'm good at. I mean, there are people who are better than me in this, so might as well do something else. And then I tried the finance bit. That didn't work. Then I joined my family business, which is super non-traditional. We export machinery to Africa, so agro-processing industry and setting up plants to make paper, ketchup, starch. And a couple of years in Africa made me realize that I don't want to do this as well. So I came back, and one of my friends told me over a coffee that this word like startup and Flipkart had just become a unicorn. So he said that, why don't you look at like meeting founders and stuff and see if like you want to maybe angel invest. I had never heard of that word. So I went, home and like started Googling all of this stuff. And the first thing was an offline angel network, which popped up, and I wanted to join them. Like I said that I want to just come in this thing. And they said that at 26 or 27, I don't think we've had a member who's that young. So why don't you get 2 members to recommend you? And then I started writing to members of that network to like find a referral, and nobody wanted, they thought I was some random kid like this thing. And I was, I had no experience or knowledge about angel investing or startups or founders. And like, of course, I've read by then like TechCrunch and all of those things, which were like popular in 2012, 2013, but never really seen like a startup work, right? I didn't have an interface with the startup land. And when I was graduating from undergrad in 2009, startups were not commonplace. Like, I think, especially in Singapore, in Asia. Of course, they were in the US by then, but this thing. So one or two members were kind enough to respond and said that, why don't you come over for a meeting? And then I went for this offline angel investing like sort of meeting where a founder is coming and doing a 45-minute pitch. And like, super non-traditional. And I said, man, this is boring. Some of the questions that they were asking were pretty bad. They were analyzing the startup from a lens of like a regular like traditional business, and I said that this is not something that I want to do. But I still joined that network after like a little bit of a convincing from some other members and them recommending me, just because I wanted to be in the flow of things. Like, I wanted to like meet founders, and I didn't know where to meet them. And then things progressed pretty quickly. I realized that this is the angel investing 1.0 world, right? where you're coming together in a city like Delhi or like other metros and just meeting founders offline. Like you're spending 2-3 hours every alternate Saturday and coming in this thing. But I didn't want to be that. Like I think it felt too pretentious and just not like the new age version of how this should be done. Like, I mean, you're building a technology business. You shouldn't be pitching offline. Yeah. And this was like, I mean, long back in 2012, 2013. Then there were other platforms which were facilitating matchmaking of investors online. So mm-hmm. I could be in a small town in India and find an entrepreneur from, say, another town or like, say, Bangalore, which is the startup hub of India. And you could connect online and like see one recorded pitch for like, say, 100 investors coming together. So that was still a way more advanced, this thing. And by that time, in this angel investing 2.0 phase, I had at least done one or two investments. So I'd been through the process of what it takes to see the long paperwork, wet signatures required, courier of documents, collecting share certificates, losing a share certificate, and all of those other things that India makes it hard, basically, yeah. to do business. Like, I mean, ease of doing business is, of course, one ranking, but fine. I mean, doing anything in India, it takes a long time. Like, this compliance overheads and nightmare is absolutely real. And I realized, man, it shouldn't be that hard to like wire like say $5,000-$7,000 or $10,000 and wait for like 3 months to close the paperwork, right? Yeah. And then I realized that all of the best investing was done by these 5-10 star angels or unicorn founders or just generally have been experienced angel investors for a while, that all of these super angels were investing in private. They had no incentive to open up their best deal flow. Yeah. I wrote to them, I said that, hey, can I co-invest with you? I didn't have anything to offer.
Yeah.
And coincidentally, then I discovered Naval Ravikant on a Tim Ferriss show, and they were talking about like many other things. And then AngelList is something that I discovered, and he said syndicates, they allow somebody to monetize access and judgment.
Yeah.
Right. Before that, if I had to like do that, I had to become a VC fund manager, and doing VC is a full-time job. You can't have anything else. But syndicates were these pop-up structures which solved for the triangle of these three things that I mentioned previously. People who had access to star deals or allocations in star deals could now open it up privately to their friends, family, other backers with and common interest, and charge carry. Carry is what venture fund managers make if they deliver a successful outcome in an investment. And there are people like me who will be happy to pay that because we want access to the best opportunities. This is the power law business. Like grand slams matter, nothing else. Like you're not looking for 2-3x. Return from an illiquid investment in 10 years. You're looking for like 50, 100x multiples and this thing. So the outcomes really matter. So I want to have access to the best opportunities, and founders have to, for say a 200k, 500k seed round back in the day, had to take 50 signatures and chase everyone together. So all three pieces of this angel investing were unhappy, right? I mean, they were not able to like sort of come together, and AngelList syndicates solved this. Like, beautifully in a first principled way, and this was working beautifully using an online software driven platform in US. And I said, why can't this exist in India? Like, I mean, India is one of the most exciting top three startup ecosystems of the world. And then the story happened, and then Naval said that we've studied India and it doesn't work here. And that's when I like said that, shit, I need to study this. So went back to the drawing board, reached out to some lawyers and stuff, and they said that, I mean, we've discussed with regulators, none of them understand like this online investing bit. And I mean, one thing led to another, but I mean, I became an advisor, and Naval said that if you can convince the Indian regulators to launch this in India, you'll be able to lead a good business here. Mm-hmm. It took me a year and a half, a lot of, I mean, waiting at the regulator's office, SEBI, and a lot of other things at the, I mean, which led to another white paper submissions and like a whole bunch of different things. I don't even want to remember that phase. But 1.5 years of like hardcore struggle with the regulators and just generally paper pushing and stuff. And we finally were there. We launched in January 2018. And man, like I hired one of my friends from the work industry, Prakhar. He was my first hire. And we, I mean, were friends before. We were colleagues together, and nobody knew what syndicates are. Like, I mean, because imagine right now everybody knows syndicates.
Yeah.
You can, I mean, you mention the word syndicate, you know, carry, all of this stuff, pooling of capital, single SPV comes to mind automatically. Imagine in 2018, nobody's heard the word syndicates and convincing an entire startup ecosystem that this is how investing will be done now. Yeah. So it was hard, but it was fun. So first 6 months, I think, were pretty fun. Like, I remember, like, going on lunches or dinners with Prakhar, and we're like still cold calling people and like, hey guys, syndicates is launched, like this is what you should do and blah blah blah, and people are like, why should I pay carry, why am I not directly on the cap table? But that's, I mean, another long story. But yeah, so the first 6 months were hard, but convincing the entire startup ecosystem that syndicates are here to stay was uphill task, but I'm glad we are here today.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think it's been a huge service to the Indian startup ecosystem, because these are vehicles that need to come up to advance the ecosystem, democratize it. And it's so glad that, you know, multiple such instruments now exist. But this is interesting, Utsav, right? I mean, you started angel investing at a time when there were not as many startups nor investors. Today, the barrier to entry to becoming an angel investor is lowered, right? I mean, it's very easy to perhaps go and start investing if you, of course, have the capital, and there are platforms, there are networks, all of that, and there are startups available who want to raise capital. Now, while all of that is great, there's also, you know, the power law which exists, and becoming a 1% angel investor still seems to be a uphill task. Talk to us about how you've seen this part of the ecosystem evolve, right? And what your thoughts are on how maybe angel investing responsibly can be done. Because we all know that, or the few of us who do have the awareness that this is a risky asset class, does that awareness, is that lacking? How's that going in your thought?
You rightly said it's very easy to get started. Like, I mean, it's never been easier to get started, and it's never been tougher to build a brand doing something exceptionally well, because I think the content, knowledge, all of that information arbitrage, which probably existed early in the day when I started like doing investments in 2014, 2015, is gone. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows what angel investing is. Everybody knows what a startup is. Everybody knows the same playbook, like in terms of how to build a brand, what like other things like you to look for in a startup and stuff. All of that is put out. Like, it's all open source now to the world. Yeah. I think, I mean, I'm referring to Naval again and again, because of course someone who I really, really admire and look up to. He mentioned this thing, productize yourself. Hmm. These two words. And they've stuck with me because, I mean, what are you good at so uniquely that you can do and have a chance of being in the top 20-25% of the world doing that, and then build a brand around it, and then see how you can monetize it. Like, you're doing the whole sort of playbook by starting with content and, I mean, becoming connected with some of the best unicorn founders. If I reach out to some of the best unicorn founders, I probably don't have anything to offer to them, nor will they be getting giving me anything else, like, except maybe a random phone call, which will not amount to much. But with you, they're connecting for this podcast, and through your network, they might get connected to other people. They might get their personal word out about their companies, about their personal brand, or the work that they're doing in their own startups and stuff. So there is somewhat of a good this thing, and you've productized that pretty well. And I would say you're the leading podcast creator for like startup content in the country right now. And that has become your brand. And for you to like now, like sort of monetize this by offering other startup founders an investment check, but also your reach, I think is very powerful. So think about everybody who's starting up now. You can learn angel investing in literally at least the rule book. You can learn in a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. Then it's an art that you can just improve over and over as you keep on doing it. Right. Your first 10 investments will probably be crap. And yeah, your next 10 will still get better. And your next 10 might be some of the best ones.
Yeah.
So, and it's a non-linear game, like we've mentioned, right? I mean, more times than not, like what I've seen from my personal investing is when some of the things that I've said no to, knowing what I've seen and learned over this time, I would have said yes to. Mm-hmm. Because it takes, I mean, 1x downside, but 100x upside. And some of them have been really great companies that have been built. So I said more, I mean, I think I should have said more yes than probably no. Like, to be honest, that's my one key learning in angel investing. Of course, but have a prepared mind and mind and a prepared gut. And that is something that you only refine after you've interacted with hundreds of founders, hundreds of co-investors, and spoken of like future round investors as well. So all of this comes together, but be part of the game in a passionate way. Like, I think a lot of people are just going about angel investing because it's a cool dinner conversation. But I mean, if you're not passionate about the game, you're not able to increase the odds of success for a founder that you're backing in a 5, 10, 20, 30% meaningful way, right? Yeah. Then you're not going to stick around in this game too long, because cycles will come and go. And now when we're in a sort of like a down market cycle where macros are somewhat getting tested and wonky every day, that is when you realize that when the tide goes away, who's still in swimming and still not swimming. So I think have that passion so that you at least play the game long enough. I've been doing this for 9 years and I'm still learning something new every single day, to be honest. Like, yeah. I'm still blown away by something new that I hear. I'm like still learning about new industries. Like, I mean, every day there's a new industry, new platform, there's new like things to learn about. And I mean, to me, I think angel investing also helps me, I mean, apart from the financial returns and stuff, become a better, a thinker and an operator myself. Like, I mean, I mean, it's the best form of pseudo entrepreneurship that I've ever received. Like, I think I'm getting like a master's in entrepreneurship, like every single day through all of these calls and conversations that I have with founders. And I think it's somewhat direct gain and indirect gain both. So be passionate about like this thing, and that's the only way that you'll outlast somebody who's just popped in for a day in this industry.
Got it. No, I think that's very important to echo. Goes to like, go ahead and prove the fundamentals of angel investing, and very important to understand, because otherwise, you know, it can seem very easy, but it's not. It's challenging, it's risky, and there's a lot of downside in the asset class. So yeah, of course. But no, this is interesting. This also begs the question, and this is something you've spoken about in the past, of about smart capital, right? And there's a lot of chatter in the ecosystem around capital is available in plentiful, it's been commoditized. With your fund, what you've done with open LPs, with a global network, you've spoken about this a lot, and you know, have this extensive network of founders where the capital means more than the check that you write. It has more value to it. Talk to us about this principle, how you've looked at it, how this has also evolved.
Sure. So I think in the US, I had seen two of my colleagues, Neve and Ryan, who were our colleagues, at least from the US counterpart, where they've productized themselves through these micro funds. And angel has democratized the infra to create these micro funds and nano funds, right? And solo capitalist was becoming a trend. And more recently, it's become like a driving force of the early stage venture ecosystem. So I saw them that they've raised from amazing LPs and stuff, and they wanted to be the most helpful check. Like, they can now write a 100, 200K check to an early stage founder, and he gets access to all of these publicly disclosed 50, 60, 70 LPs who are operators of top companies and have built, sold, and listed companies. And like, you're getting the brain power of like 50, 60, 70 people with one single check. Imagine how powerful that is for a founder, right? Yeah. And all of this publicly disclosed and in a very transparent way. So it's like, what is my value prop in India? Mm-hmm. These Indian founders come to me because AngelList is recognized in the US. So the first thing that the founders who are mostly starting up in SaaS or like even on the other industries come to me and say, hey, I want to connect with somebody who's scaled engineering teams from 10 to 100, or how do you build your US go-to-market function, or how do you build your sales team on ground in US? So the most obvious thing that I saw across the theme that I saw across them was that they wanted to tap onto the US market in either a knowledge way, in the way of knowledge or in capital or like something or the other, and they came to me for that. So I said, the US-India corridor is here to stay. I think US is, of course, decades of know-how in startup and technology and innovation. So this thing will keep popping up. Let's make that a theme and let's build a fund around this where people get 100, 200K from me, but they get the brain power of some of the best operators in the US. Mm-hmm. And I might not be the smartest check on their cap table. Like, personally, I don't have much to offer in terms of like technical know-how or like US this thing. But I can at least leverage that network and bring the Indian founders closer to the US market. So that became iSeed. And the first fund was a $4 million fund. And we've invested in 35 companies. That's almost close to a 3x markup. We started investing in 2020, ended investing in March 21. Then I raised iSeed Fund 2, which was even bigger and in terms of its LP base and more operators and more founders across the world. The majority of the capital was US. We did a $21 million fund. Some VC funds also came together to back that. So it was honestly one-stop shop for a founder to take this 200K check and get access to some of the best minds. And I'm super, super quick in terms of connecting them to people and asking LPs for help. And the LPs are also glad because they end up learning about the Indian market and also sometimes directly investing in these founders. So it became a win-win for everything. And I see it's been that sort of vehicle for me where I stay connected to the ecosystem and the founders, and I try to help them with my clear value proposition by opening up the US market for them.
Got it. Fair enough. I guess, you know, it's important to echo the right to win, as they say, right? And this becomes one very interesting way to actually win interesting founders, interesting investments, and how you've been able to leverage it is a very fascinating playbook. What I also want to refer to, Utsav, is one very evident and fascinating theme, at least from afar for me, of your career has been how you've been able to reinvent yourself, or at least that's how it seems. So you could take the angel investing journey and go from syndicates to a fund. You've, with Angelist India, of course, led multiple initiatives. You've done Galaxy now. There's Equity List, which is now spun off as well. So you've done multiple things at multiple points in your career. Talk to us about what the individual mindset behind that is, right? How do you define your own growth trajectory and what the mindset behind some of these initiatives has been, less as much as what these initiatives are?
Oh, boy. So when we were, I mean, all of this in hindsight, right? When you're like doing this operating day to day, you don't think about these things. You're like, okay. You show up to work and you're like, man, we need to push today. Like, I mean, you need to push. Like, that was the mindset that I was operating in. The drive and the hunger was there on a daily basis because, I mean, startups are in the do or die business, right? I mean, if I had to be an old company, I can be stagnant and just keep on growing in a linear way. But at startups, you have to see that what can you do differently? Mm-hmm. Or what experiment can you run that increases the chances of your success and also is a non-linear outcome, right? So we were thinking about new things and how to innovate on this whole thing, right? We're serving the venture and the startup ecosystem using our technology and platform. What new things can we do to improve us in our delivery of services, but also, like, I mean, bring a non-linearity into this business? I mean, you're in the do or die business. It's go to work every day, innovate or die. Like, that is it. Like, I mean, that's what startups are. Like, if they can't do that on a daily basis, we have to, then relook, go back to the drawing board pretty frequently that if you're not pushing out something new, then something is not working, right? And how do we find that energy, right? I mean, one of the key reasons for startup failure is not running out of money. It's running out of energy and momentum. So how do you, like, stay on it? I think that was the thing. So many of the early things that we did, the collective, I think Angelus, I mean, all of this was heavily inspired by what Angelus US has done. Angelus US runs Access Fund, where they were trying to sort of build an index fund of early stage companies by backing various syndicates. So I said, let's spin up. I mean, we were in our first year itself, we backed some very good companies through various syndicates, and VC funds and VC partners used to come to us and say, hey, why don't we see this deal flow on your platform? So I said, why don't you put some money here and we'll call it a collective. Founders win because they get VC money pretty quickly and in a no signal risk environment because you're not coming directly on the cap table, but you're coming through our entity. GPs get access to more capital because we are still in that building up phase where we were getting syndicate leads were getting sort of their brands built up. So they still needed help with capital sourcing and stuff. So it solved for all of that together in a very clean, crisp format. We did 70, 75 investments from the collective. That became a pretty interesting setup. Then we did Equity List. Cap table management in India and globally, I think, is a big pain, right? You have many stakeholders in your company, not just investors, but like founders, employees, advisors and stuff, and all of this needs to be managed cleanly. So we'd seen other people do this globally, but nobody was doing this properly for India, so we did Equity List. And the vision was that, and the thinking behind that was, and Sumukh was leading that project for us, he was an engineer at Angelus India, then Angelus US, and he joined us for a bit, to build the startup operating system. Like, I mean, Angelus globally across Product Hunt, Talent, and Venture was doing fundraise, recruit, and launch pretty well. Mm-hmm. But how do you manage your equity as well and manage your stakeholders as well? So that fit in pretty neatly into our ecosystem. So we did Equity List. And We've done many new things, and Sparehead was one program that, I mean, personally, I really admired what Naval has done with Sparehead in the US. It was giving founders their first fund using the AngelList infrastructure to start investing in their peers. Because, and the thinking behind that was, it was like a Y Combinator style model where you find an exciting set of operators at the early stage who are not that liquid, but have a strong founder network, because, I mean, typically a founder is helping other founders on weekends and nights, right? Yeah. And it, I mean, they already spend the time, but they're not able to give them a check or have more meaningful skin in the game. Yeah. So we give them the infrastructure, we give them the know-how about angel investing, and we do, coach them on it was learn as you do, like, sort of program. And we launched that for India called Galaxy, backed by some awesome people like Naval, Tim Ferriss, Nivi, Elliot Gill, Lockheed Groom, founder of Thumbtack, and many other people came together to back that program. And we've selected 6 people now so far. And we'll announce a second cohort pretty soon. Idea is to keep innovating, keep doing products for founders, investors, and just keep pushing the needle forward, basically.
Absolutely, you know, I can imagine, and it shows with the results. On the Galaxy bit, if you had to double click, this founder-led capital as a theme, of course, you know, is a very great mark of a developing ecosystem, and one that is succeeding in nature because liquidity flows, and that's how capital kind of rotates itself. How have you seen this, play out in the ecosystem? Where are we at in India with regards to it?
In US, it's a developed market. Almost every founder who's somewhat of hit a certain scale in his company, he or she is definitely investing. And why do they do that? I think giving back is one thing, but also for them to keep abreast of what's happening in the ecosystem, the best playbooks to follow when you're scaling up engineering teams. Being a founder is a very lonely journey. Some of the best founders won't talk about this publicly, but they face the imposter syndrome, they face loneliness, they face self-doubt, all of this constantly. Yeah. And investing in other founders can somewhat make this less lonely for you. And it can help you become a better operator. I've seen this. After the first 10, 20 investments, I was learning something new from every investor update or every call with these founders. So yeah. I think it's you have to do it. You're almost always spending time with other founders, right? Mm-hmm. Even if you don't have the money, now there is infrastructure like AngelList to do this, where you can monetize your access and judgment and time and all of those things. Or there are programs like Sparehead and Galaxy, where you can get the capital to start investing along with some handholding as well. Mm-hmm. So the idea is for a founder, always keep investing. I think if you can do that, there's never a better time to start investing in other founders. And I think it's a practice that many people question at times, that do founders get carried away? Mm-hmm. And depends on the stage of the company, to be honest. If you're running a decacon, you have more time on your hand because your team is very well developed by then and your path is set, right? You're a big company by then. In the early stage, of course, don't get distracted by it. Don't treat it as your primary activity. It should always remain a passion-driven hobby that you use to upskill yourself from time to time.
Got it. Fair enough. Great. I think, moving forward, I'd also love to gauge some of these, just broad principles that maybe you've spoken about in private conversations with me or with others that I've had the pleasure to observe. But there's this thing called, separating substance from the noise, right? And a lot of it, especially with your exposure to global networks, talking to some really accomplished founders, investing in some unicorns, must have developed with time. A lot of this judgment, right? Talk to us about how have you been able to develop that? What does this principle mean to you?
In terms of investing in founders, or you mean like?
Just general ecosystem-wise.
Oh, wow. I think it went from, in terms of my personal thinking and belief system in this ecosystem is involved, depending on where you ask me this question on. But in the early days, I wanted to be more involved. I wanted to be at every possible event possible. I wanted to be seen. I wanted to speak at panels. I wanted to be publicly known for the work that I've done. But as I've come now, where I've already built out most of my address book, where I know who I love working with and who I don't enjoy working with, I've realized that I want to be away from the limelight or away from the noise and stuff. And I think That possibly comes from the fact that you've spent enough time. You've seen that most of it is noise, and most of it is most of these people won't care about you if you're not doing what you're doing. And there are very few people who matter to you and will matter to you and actually truly genuinely care for you. So you start becoming a little bit disconnected and also more private as a person. And I've become that over sort of this 6-7 year Angelist India journey and like sort of decade long in the startup ecosystem. I've stopped attending events, stopped doing any panels and stuff. And now I've become more of a private person. You can see that from my social media handles and stuff. I'm not posting original content. And somebody asked me, why am I not doing that, this thing? So my answer was, it could either be a mix of two things, indifference or fear of judgment. Where I'm like, I don't want to deal with trolls online, or I don't want to explain myself to somebody online. Or it can be indifference that, sure, I've attained somewhat of a content nirvana where I'm not looking to like do brand building all the time. But being brief in brevity, like I've seen some of the smartest people who I've interacted with, they are so brief, like they're crisp. Like, I mean, Naval and Angelist have this writing piece called The Day You Become a Better Writer. It's one of the documents that I read very early on. It's, I think, by the creator of Dilbert, the comic strip. And he said that most of business writing, I think you can just take away the fluff, literally. I think we use so many adjectives and stuff, which are probably not very important. So that, I think, has shaped my thinking that I want to have brief conversations. I don't even like to do 30-minute calls, 30-minute Zoom calls. I think most of the Zoom calls and most of the work, everything can be done async and in 5 to 10 minutes, literally. And depending on the smartness of the other receiving, the person on the other end as well. So try to be brief as well. And I think that can work in your favor. But if you're working in large teams, I think that can work against you as well. Yeah. And that is why Dhruv, who's now leading the day-to-day operations at Angelist India, I think is a way better operator than I am, because I'm way more brief and I like to communicate less as well than I should be doing. So I think there's a skill set for everything and everyone. And I think everyone's going through their own separate journeys as well. But for me, I think being brief, being private, I think is, I'm in that phase of life right now in my career.
Absolutely. No, that's super helpful to know. And I'm glad you mentioned that brevity pointer, because I've heard you talk about that before as well. And that's a special skill, I'm guessing. I mean, it's very important to develop, and it's glad to have that echoed. Uthav, I'd also love to know that, you know, considering you've had a investing career in which you've had seen wins, you've of course seen, you know, passes as well, legend has it, you've spoken about the Meesho story as well. But from the wins, right, when you've developed this sort of judgment in investing and you've observed outlier founders, has there been anything very distinctive that you've come to realize or come to admire, which is different than what, you know, general reality would be? We understand, you know, perseverance, the general ones, but what are the unique outlier traits that you feel define great founders?
I think investing has been purely luck. Like, I don't think most VCs take, or investors take, too much credit. Mm-hmm. Somebody posted about this recently where they said that most investors will be net positive. They just help retweet and just say, great update, cheers.
Yeah.
To every investor update. They'll be helpful, then I would say 70-80% of the investors. Like, most investors think that they can like fulfill their dream of backseat driving and stuff when they invest in a startup. I don't think that's, I think that's a net negative in most cases. Mm-hmm. For me, I think luck has played a big, big part. Like, I think some of the best wins have been where I didn't think too much. I didn't try to over-intellectualize this stuff. Of course, I don't want to bet in an industry which I know I'm not comfortable investing in, like, or I know that's not a large enough industry, right? If somebody told me that they're selling soda water, their entire country, I think, sells tonic water for like 60 crores, so that's not a big enough market. So you need to have that level of judgment, right? But if they check all the boxes, then, I mean, founder market fit is one of the biggest things, right? All of these founders experience the problem personally in most cases. So they're passionate about it. Goes back to the point where you'd really need to have experienced the problem personally to live through it long enough to deliver a solution for it to the market at scale. Mm-hmm. Right? So that, I think, is very key. Like, I think the biggest wins have been, say, BharatPay, CoinDCX, Pristine Care. All of these founders have really, like, I mean, Sumit was trying to buy crypto, and, like, I mean, the open order exchange book system didn't exist. And when it did, like, the liquidity wasn't good enough. So he really built out the exchange that he wanted for himself, right?
Yeah.
So you see these, like, trends. Like, in the best founders, they are so passionate about the problem. They've probably experienced it personally, that there's some element of founder market fit. And on a long enough time horizon, if they've not done well in this startup, they'll probably do well in the next startup. You just continue backing these founders. Like, all of the founders I've backed, with the exception of maybe a couple, I will back all of these founders blindly when they start up something else. Because you know that these are, like, I mean, to me, they're like strong, passionate people, and like on a long enough time horizon in their life, they're going to be successful.
Got it. Interesting. Out of curiosity, when we were talking about this briefly before the recording started, that when there's a lot of, you know, content absorption, when you're trying to develop this prepared mind, you're absorbing a lot, right? But how much are you originally thinking? You, of course, are an avid reader. You've come to admire Naval. You've read a lot. But how do you maintain that originality? Or how do you reflect enough to have maybe original thoughts, ideas, personality? Have you thought about this? What are your ideas there?
I think we're all inspired people. Like, I think we mold ourselves to what we're reading, the five chimp theory, right? Like, I mean, if you read, I mean, there was a phase in life, and I mean, I wanted to be a DJ because I think three of my friends were into music then, right? Mm-hmm. So I started mixing music. And if I've read like five philosophy books in a row, or five, like, I don't know, like something, then I'll start posting about philosophy as well. So it's honestly like a phase of life. Like, I think nothing's permanent and nobody's permanent. Of course, you have your overall personality, that you might be aggressive, you might be more introverted, or you might be something else, like this thing. Those broad traits and principles and values will remain the same, but you tend to get inspired by what you're consuming. Nobody, I think, is an original thinker. Very few. Like, I would say, I mean, number of original thinkers in this world are less than like 40 or 50 who can synthesize an original thought and, like, I mean, put it out there in a crystal clear format. So I don't think there are many people who can do that. Most of the world is inspired and derived. Right. So I think, I mean, depends on what I'm reading, to be honest. Like, sometimes I read like more business books, or reading about like this thing. So I'm thinking more on those lines, and I go down that rabbit hole. Like, maybe now I'm spending more time on my personal health. So I'm reading so much about nutrition, listening to Huberman's podcast, and like all of those other things. So it's a very derivative world out there. Like,
absolutely.
You are what you consume. If I spend like 2 hours on Instagram, I might start talking about fashion to you. So that, I mean, it changes, like, depends on what you consume. So that's why be careful, because I think there's a lot of junk out there, and you need to be protective of your own time and attention. And I mean, your attention is your limited bandwidth resource right now, right? So you have to be very, very mindful of what you consume. I mean, same with food. Like, I mean, you have only so much space in your stomach, and if you're eating junk all day, then it's going to show up sooner or later.
Absolutely. Fair enough. Interesting to hear that. I think, you know, going forward, I'd also love to know that, considering that you had multiple things on your radar almost every phase of your life. So even when, you know, of course, leading AngelList, you've had the syndicate alongside, you've had other curiosities you've explored, you're focusing on health now, you focus on family, all of that, right? What I'm trying to eye at is, I know time management is an overused phrase, but when you look at how you can best leverage your time, your skills, your advantages, how have you sort of planned the future? Look at short-term goals. How do you kind of manage this spectrum of how to best utilize your time? And in that phase, how have you sort of prioritized?
Yeah, so when we were talking about other principles and stuff, we spoke about brevity, but the other thing which, like, just popped up in my head was saying no. Like, I say no so much now. Like, it's unbelievable. Like, I mean, my by default answer is no. Like, I mean, and I've learned this term, which I think people don't take pretty badly. I mean, they don't take it negatively. Whenever somebody says that, hey, can I introduce you to this person? So I said, I would like to politely decline this opportunity. So those two words, for some reason, have been magic for me, like politely decline. So I started using them very frequently together.
Tell us more. I mean, when do you do this? Like, how do you evaluate when to say no?
Yeah, because I mean, see, there are a few things like, as you become more connected in the startup ecosystem, they'll, or you have a fund of your own, people will want to introduce you to other founders and like this thing. And I know that I'm not investing in like D2C brands, or I'm not investing in, say, HR tech, or I'm not investing in something, and unlikely that this conversation, next conversation is going to change my mind. So I don't want to, I want to be mindful of the founder's time as well, right? I mean, I don't want to come on a 30-minute call and then just listen to you, this thing, the time that could have been spent on you building your company, or like you doing something more productive than speaking to me who is already disinterested. So that, of course, goes in the no bucket, and I say that I politely declined this opportunity. Maybe in the future, if things change, I'll reach out or something like that. So I started saying no more frequently. Like, I started saying no to travel as well. Early days of Angelus India, I used to get on a flight and just go. And COVID made me realize that most of the meetings can literally be a call. Most of the meetings can be an email as well. And some of the text messages on WhatsApp and stuff, I've realized voice notes are just amazing. Game changer. And even on Slack and stuff. So asynchronous communication, I've adopted to that fully. So saying no to more meetings and stuff, because most meetings are waste of time. Like, I think you can get more done in different times. And luckily, Angelus India is a small team. So everyone's self-driven and like everyone's motivated, so you can manage that. I can imagine being in a big company or a corporation, I think that can be a problem. So saying no to like many other things as well. Like, I don't, there has to be some level of serendipity also. So I might lose out on that by saying no to like many of these, say, coffee meetings or many of these lunch or dinner meetings that, hey, I might land up on like learning about a new great book or a new great podcast from somebody, or a new great like movie or a TV show from somebody, but that's the cost that you pay. So there is a fine balance between this. I think as you refine your own gut, I think you'll start having less FOMO and JOMO. JOMO is joy of missing out.
I think Naval has a blog or a tweet which says you should not have time for coffee. And I think
funny enough, he actually has had the domain I don't do coffee. .com. So, yeah.
Very interesting. No, that's super to hear. And I think part of time management is that. But I mean, has it ever fascinated you to maybe have depth versus breadth? The reason I ask is, you know, a lot of people just wonder and want to do their life's best work, involved very deeply in one aspect, considering that, you know, you've been an operator alongside being an investor and you're wearing multiple hats, you know, with other projects, you're investing in crypto projects, all of that. Has that ever been a botheration?
Not really. Early on, always be a generalist in your career.
Okay.
If you're starting up, you have to have a wide surface area. You want to cover as many topics as possible. You want to meet as many people as possible. You want to do as many things as possible. Life is very, very short, and you don't want to be bogged down in one particular hole, right? I think you want to explore as much as possible. But that being said, if you want to get the monetary rewards or the fame and the fortune in a particular field, you need to go deep. That doesn't come by being shallow or a generalist.
Got it. Fair enough. Coming to, you know, just like thinking about the future, I think you were, you know, very monumental, or at least you did a lot of crypto investing, you invest in projects, you were early to buy an NFT. How do you see the world from a future lens? I know in personal conversations we've asked the question that, you know, what's the asset class that's going to be the future? You're thinking about what's next, all of that, right? How do you evaluate and make judgments about the present, what you've looked at, and then maybe look at the future?
The best part about being an investor is that I don't have to predict the future, to be honest. And in part of crystal ball gazing, like, I want to give you like 10 answers about right now AI is hot, or maybe NFTs was hot last year or something like that. But I don't have that answer, like, to be honest. So I don't like to crystal ball gaze. I just want to have a big enough surface area that I get connected with the smartest minds in this country when they're trying to build the future. And my job there is to just help him scale that to as many people as possible. Yeah.
No, I mean, beyond the investing bit, like, I mean this from a more personal mindset or a personal sort of principle, right? How do you just evaluate the future, like, from a personal lens? Because all of us are asking the question, not what's hot, but what can we do in the future that really magnifies our impact in the world, right? Is there a mental model that helps you evaluate that?
I think what I want to do is maybe find something that I can stick with for at least 7 to 10 years. I think that is the key, like, decision-making criteria in where I want to spend my personal time on. And I'm like, I mean, in my mid-30s and stuff. So I want to be more dedicated with my time to finding this something which I know will stick with me for the next 7 to 10 years. And I don't have that answer right now. So I think it's a very continuous iterative process, but a lot more thought goes into it. Like when I was starting investing, it was 25, 26, I was in my mid-20s. So I had more time to fail then. Mm. I have less time to fail now. Like my energy levels are, of course, needs to be managed. My time needs to be managed with family and like all of those things. So those considerations also come in. So it depends on where you are at in terms of your personal journey. But I do think about it very actively. As in when I have the answer, I'll definitely come on the show again and share with you. But the mental model is where you're at, manage your time, manage your energy, and think about it more deliberately if you're in the later stage of your career.
Got it.
Where you have more to lose in terms of not just a personal brand, but also like time and like other things as well, right? So you're... That has to be one of the key decision-making frameworks as well.
Fair enough. Another interesting thing that you've recently, or I mean, you've always had a fascination for is health, right? And this is something that you've brought up in one of our quarterly check-ins internally, where you were like, work and everything aside, what are you doing about your health? Talk to us about like what sparked that, right? I mean, you have a strong like routine to actually focus on your health. You've been doing a lot right now as well in the recent quarter. What inspired you to actually get focused, and what beyond work and beyond health are curiosity areas that you've ended up exploring, going deep into?
Only when you hit rock bottom in something, be it personal relationships, be it health, that's when you realize the importance of it. And I think I hit that in my health as well. Easy to get, I mean, this thing that you feel busy, right? I mean, the constant feeling of feeling busy, or I'm doing this, but I, being busy at work, it allows me like 10 extra packets of chips over this week, right? Or I can have a pizza, this thing. Easy to get carried away by feeling busy and then replacing that by like guilt-free eating or something, or like, I don't know, having bad habits and stuff in health. So when I hit that rock bottom in health, where I was like, man, this cannot go on for longer. I think my energy is suffering, my work is suffering, my mood is suffering, my personal relationships are suffering and everything. That's when I was like, let's take this challenge up. Like, let's figure out health as well. It can't be that hard, right? I mean, and building self-control also is very hard. Like for many people, building self-control is, I think, almost impossible. And so health is, half of the battle is self-control in health. And luckily, I mean, startup ecosystem talks about it pretty frequently, but doesn't do much about it. Like, I think we glamorize being busy more than, say, being fit more. And I think being healthy, I think, is the status symbol of the future, I think, than anything else. So with this in mind, like, I mean, I came across the Ultra Human founders who taught me about new advanced things, right? I mean, I always wore an Apple Watch so you can track the calories and stuff. And then now with this Ultra Human, like glucose monitoring patch, you can literally have a dashboard to your body with everything that you put in. So you have more real-time feedback. I eat a packet of chips and I know my glucose is going to spike. So you're getting that feedback real-time. Then now there's an Ultra Human ring. So you get to like track your sleep more properly. And I think sleep is the best drug that you can take in this world. Like, you sleep 8 hours, you're a beast tomorrow morning on most occasions. So all of these things combined, I think it hit rock bottom. Then it's your job to pull yourself out there. And nobody else is coming to save you in this world. So you got to do it for yourself.
Yeah. Anything beyond health that you're really curious about and that you've, you know, just dive deeper into, explode as a rabbit hole?
I went down the rabbit hole of music. I think I started producing electronic music once. Like I mentioned, like some of my friends were this thing. So I got a SoundCloud page and like was recording mixes and like I'd gotten the DJ setup as well. So I have these bursts of things. Like, I mean, I became a marathon runner in the middle and now, I mean, starting back up again. So I pick up these things for a couple of months maybe and do them at stretch, like maybe even gardening. Like I've gotten a new pet, so I'm like all about him right now, me and my wife. And then so you do these things in small passion bursts and something or the other sticks and stays with you long enough. But keep on experimenting. I think that's the key thing that I've realized, that I get bored pretty frequently. And that is I mean, in personal life as well, but professional life also, I think that worked because I didn't want to be doing like Angels India shouldn't just be a syndicate platform, right? It should be doing many new things. It should be reinventing the wheel time and again. And because if you're pioneers in something, then you just got to like think with those shoes on. So I think helps me in my personal life and professional life be bored frequently. So it can be, I mean, if you ask me this question, like 3 months down the line, it can be like something I'm different. Like becoming a gardener, like I think for my colony's park. So it's different at different times.
Is this very natural, inbuilt, since childhood, or is this more deliberate in nature and a proxy for curiosity, which also defines you? How have you thought about that?
No, I don't think there's anything. It's not deliberate for sure. I think I just get bored pretty frequently. So I think that's part of the reason why I don't want to talk to too many people also, because most of the conversations are boring. Like, I mean, and a proxy for them is the content that they put out or like the kind of emails that they write. I know that this person can be interesting or this founder can be interesting. So I try to like gatekeep my time and attention pretty frequently through these like sort of heuristics and stuff. But being bored frequently, I think helps. I think having that natural curiosity in conjunction with being bored frequently definitely helps.
Fair enough.
It's not... I mean, I've not like learnt it from something. I think it's just basically.
And I think like a lot of people often talk about just like creating free time or like building like boredom into your schedule. That's also like a good proxy to understand that, okay, that can expand your creative outbursts, maybe that. But that's why I was curious to know what the system is for you.
Running Angels India, you become overscheduled. Like, I mean, we're like running these calendars, which are like, I mean, every 30 minutes there's a call, every 20 minutes there's like something or the other. So you tend to not have that free time to think about it. And it comes from a position of privilege. Like, I can, like, I mean, step back and say that I don't want to like leave this life. And not 99% of the people can't probably say this, right? Yeah. Depends on their situation as well. So that comes from a position of privilege, and I want to highlight that. But being bored, I think, definitely helps, and not leading an overscheduled life. All of this is, I mean, you'll see, is a derivative from Naval. Like, I've probably read like many books and many podcasts about philosophy, life, time management, personal family management and stuff. But still, his learning has stuck with me because it's brief. Like, it's, I mean, everything that he's teaching is probably fitting in a tweet. And that's why his content has transcended so many geographies and boundaries and ecosystems and like industries, because it's brief.
Absolutely. Now, since we've spoken about Naval and his learnings and how it's shaped your habits, life learnings, all of that, he often also says that you can't just like take my learning and have it transferable. You have to apply it to your own context. What is your sort of mantra for like, you know, reflecting on it or just like thinking about it further or applying your context to it?
I think it's very personal and depends on what phase of life you're at in. Like, I mean, I'm probably not taking enough non-linear bets in my life or risks in my life at this point of time than I as much as I should be. So it depends, very personal. Like, somebody might enjoy something about his tweet about having children in life and how you start to love somebody else more than yourself when you have children, or somebody can relate more to like certain other tweets. So it's very, very personal. It's a snapshot in time of your life where you think about certain things more deeply than others. So for me, it can vary from time to time. I've known him for now 6.5 years, so like something might be more relatable in my early half than say now. And getting to know him as an individual and as a person and as a mentor and as a general human being, I think has been one of the most rewarding experiences of my life. And building out Angels India has been one of that top one or two most rewarding experiences, but knowing Naval and working with him and getting his blessing has been definitely right up there. So many of them I can't share publicly, but I think he's had a profound impact on my life.
No, absolutely. I can only imagine. And it's just like the way you're talking about it also just shows a lot of character. So I'm sure it's made a huge impact. If I had to ask you, you know, what do we who don't see as, you know, the general public learning and understanding from him vis-a-vis somebody who's had the opportunity to know him decently closely, what have you learned maybe uniquely or anything to that extent?
I mean, I'm not in a position to generalize it, but I think everyone's human. Like, that's what I've realized. Some of the smartest people, everyone is human. Like, they make their own mistakes. They live through it and they think about it and then they, I mean, learn it. I mean, learn something from it and then share it with others. Like, I think everyone's human and I think everyone's trying to, like, figure out life. Like, there is no playbook. So these guys don't have a better playbook than we do, or like God has not taught them something else, or like one of their gurujis has not taught them something else. I think everyone's taking life as it comes by the day. So like, don't be too hard on yourself. You're just another human. That's it.
Everyone's another human. Awesome. This has been very interesting. I think we've covered a lot of ground in very interesting ways. As we kind of conclude, I have a couple of just final questions. I think we've not had a chance to like chat directly about AngelList India, right? And that's, of course, a very core component of what you've built as a founder, as the founder of AngelList India, as leading it to considerable scale. And we've seen so much pioneering many instruments. What have been, I mean, I want to generalize because of I want to be due of time, but what have been your most important learnings through the journey to say that, okay, there were different challenges through different phases, but there are things that you enjoyed and made you just a better 10x operator because of things?
I think we were just riding the wave. To be honest, when we launched AngelList India, luckily AngelList India benefited from the fact that the Indian startup ecosystem and the energy on ground was so high. Like, I mean, so many people wanted to invest. So I think there was a lack of good options, or like, I mean, there was a flood of people who wanted to come and invest in an online platform and in exciting startup opportunities in like many of these awesome founders who were starting up. And AngelList India just happened to be there in a very nice, trustworthy, clean way, right? So we've scaled up to 250 million in AUM. We've backed like over 600 founders and 600 companies in India. So we've built out a nice online platform, which has become this place where it's become this place where innovation is coming to get funded pretty regularly. And all of this scaled up using software, and our infrastructure's been robustly handled by stuff that we've done online and offline. And the key learning was that just be a reliable place to do business. Like, I think generally, like, I think overall in life, like, I think most platforms or people, or like, I'm generalizing, say X but do Y. Like, if you just say X and do X, you have won, like, I think 80% of the battle in life. Like, I think you don't even need to promise magic or moon or stars or Mars to anyone. If you can just promise this, that you will, like, I mean, reply to this email by end of the day. If you've replied, you're honestly, I think, in the good books of somebody. So same, that we did the same at AngelList India. And personally as well, I try to maintain this philosophy where just like, do what you're promising, right? Or don't promise, just say that, be real, like, with people. I think the problem is that across this corporate jugglery and like all of these things in life, we've stopped treating people, it's easy to be somebody else behind a keyboard, right? We've stopped treating people as real people. So I think be real with people, and I think things will eventually work out. And we built AngelList India with a very small team. Everyone's delivering high impact work. No politics, no titles, flat this thing. Remote first, we trust everyone blindly, and everyone's doing some of the best work of their career. So, I mean, the team has delivered phenomenally, and we're glad to have you. And our friendship has grown to this date where I'm like sitting and appearing on a podcast with you. So I think trust and transparency and keeping your word, I think, is half the battle won. And we've learned and had good colleagues who've done all of that.
Yeah, no, of course. I think it's been a huge honor, and I'm so glad of that opportunity. But hearing you talk about that specific bit, right? I remember you've also mentioned to me once, just like, if you can reply to like 50% of the people in, you know, like, just when you say you have to, you win that. And I think whenever I've received a reply from you or responded to you, it's been like, you know, very smoothly, and I can expect like half an hour responses from you, which is almost unimaginable if you think about it, because at least from the outsider perspective, it's like, this person's busy, you know, they won't have time, but it's been phenomenal that way.
Because I'm sitting on the other side saying no to like many other things.
No, of course. I mean, no, but these small things, of course, matter. You know, I want to end with a couple of just like very quick final questions. These are more personal, and I usually talk to each founder or each guest on the other side about these things. One of the things that I'd love to ask you is, what is that, you know, one thing, and you briefly mentioned that you are uniquely good at than maybe 95% of the world. If you had to maybe put that out, what would that be?
I wouldn't say better than 95% is what you said.
I mean, put that number as it may,
I'd love to know. Quartile, I think, would be a fair estimate. Like, I think investing has been good. Like, I think for me, when I started investing, I think it was much less competitive. So I think I had, luck and many other factors which, like, contributed to that. Like, overall, probably I've invested in 140 startups. My personal IRR is close to 104% for all the investing. Many of the companies I've invested in have exited as well through secondaries or exits to larger companies. So investing has paid off well. Running a company, I wouldn't say I'm the top operator, for sure not. Like, I think there are people who are better positioned to do that and are doing that also. So I would say investing, I think, has been good for me. I think it's time to figure out what next. As somebody famous said, only the paranoid survive. So I think it's time to be back to the drawing board, keep thinking about it again and again, and see where you land.
Absolutely. Any soft skills there? Anything that you uniquely can, perseverance, hard work, long-term thinking, anything like that?
Crisp emails, I think that's it.
Crisp emails. Yeah, I'd probably testify to that.
Like, I don't think I'm an extrovert. I'm not good at public speaking, and I'm not good at many other things where, people are, specializing in. But I think crisp emails and brevity in communication, I think, has helped me pretty well.
Awesome. Perfect. That really helps. The other is, if I had to ask maybe, 10% of your founders to give me a line about Utsav, what would they commonly tell me?
Says no a lot. Always wants to do async. They would say that.
Okay, fair enough. When I talk to you about maybe, the 10-year journey, 9-year, without the years, looking back, if you had to just talk to yourself about the scaling journey personally, right? So we can look at AngelList and be like, okay, it's grown these many times, many fold. We can look at your investing IRR, as you mentioned, right? But it's very difficult to quantify just personal growth. Looking at yourself, what are you very proud of? What do you think that you could have done differently? Just analyzing yourself. The idea is, if we want to learn from just condense your 10-year experience and learn in a minute, what can you tell us?
Just stick with it. I think, that line, which I think was from the Intel founder, only the paranoid survive, Andy Grove, I think that is true. Like, I think if you're in that mission-driven phase of your life, I think just stick with it and be paranoid every single day. I know that's not the life that you want to live, so you can't do that forever. But when you're in the high growth phase of your career, I think, or your company, only the paranoid survive. So I think that's one crystal clear learning that I would love to stay fresh, always. Having a beginner's mindset on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis is, I think, just gold. And how do you go back to the drawing board and erase everything and come back up next day? That's very key to in the startup land that we're in.
Absolutely.
I'm happy to choose a different industry if I don't have that any day.
Yeah, fair enough. How do you declutter? But is there any rule of thumb for you?
For somebody, it can be physical space decluttering, and for somebody, it can be having a clean desktop. So everybody has their own rituals and stuff. So it can be having a clean calendar or clean physical space or something. So choose what works for you and do it.
Fair enough. For the second last bit, I think I'd love to ask you that Peter Thiel question, right? Which is to say that what is that one truth that you have identified, but others don't believe in?
I think I've already answered this somewhat indirectly.
Sure.
VCs give themselves too much credit. It's mostly just luck, to be honest. At the stage that we invest in, pre-seed and seed and the early parts before Series A, most of it is just luck. And how can you, your check, improve the odds of success for the founder? I think that's what you're trying to figure out with your investment together with the founder. But most of it is, I've honestly seen across 140, 150 investments, and some of them have done well, purely luck. So we take too much credit, and when we shouldn't, to be honest. I think as founder on the driver's seat, they're the ones sweating it out through blood, sweat, and tears every single day.
Yeah.
So give them the credit and give them the space to do this well.
Got it. If I had to just dive deeper there, I'd love to understand, I've actually asked this question to Vikram of Matrix, who was also on the show, but this was like a while back. But considering in investing, you can't, of course, underwrite luck, but you have to find a way to consistently get lucky, right? What do you think that is for you, or in general,
for me,
can
be? I think in this industry, I think you need to be lucky pretty early on. And what that means, getting a successful investment early on in your career, I think is one of the best ways to build up
that flight.
Future luck, right? It's like you said, right? Minute you get the first unicorn in your portfolio, then other founders want to work with you. So, and then your surface area increases. So I think it's a factor of like getting lucky early on and then having the this thing to do well.
Yeah, the asset chooses you after that.
Asset chooses you.
Fair enough. Awesome. No, I think this has been really great. I want to think of a fitting end, but I'll probably go with a generic stereotypical one. Knowing all that you do now, right? I mean, and this is like just putting things into perspective. If you had to go back to that NUS grad, if I'm not wrong, you were at NUS, and just like tell yourself something that would condense this, you graduate 2009, so 14-year journey into maybe, I don't know, 5-6 years, what would you tell yourself, any 2-3 final learnings that you want to leave us with?
Something as simple as it's going to be all right. Like, it's going to be all right. Like, I think everybody's on a different journey and stuff, and you don't have to compare it to other people. Like, I think what social media and all of these things and being in social circles or being part of a social society, you tend to start comparing yourself to other people. Mm-hmm. And that can mean financially, that can mean intellectually, that can mean like on many other things, right? And unless you're willing to like, I mean, get the 100% of that person's life, you shouldn't compare to somebody else. Yeah. Like, I mean, everybody's on a personal journey. Very hard, easy to say, but very hard to practice in reality, because of course we're social monkeys, right? End of the day. So it's going to be all right. Like, that's what I want to tell myself and other people, that it's just going to be all right. Don't compare yourself.
Yeah. And I'm guessing this comes from a safe space of knowing yourself and being self-secure. Like, has that come
all
with
time?
All
of this with the benefit of hindsight, to be honest. Like, so all of this with the benefit of hindsight, easier said than done now when I'm like here versus like back in the day. But yeah.
Got it. Perfect. I think this is a very, very fitting end. Thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
I've honestly, the hope was to derive much more of your thought process and learn from all the things that you've done. And you know, 60, 70 minutes in, I don't know how much time, but it feels like a job well done. Thank you so much for being your candid self and being very gracious with all your learnings. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm really hoping everybody listening will.
Thank you so much, and thanks everyone for your time. And Raj, thanks for asking great, great questions.
Pleasure.